Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Our homes, our lives are full of stuff. And it seems that much of the time we approach this as a storage problem. But for our guest for this hour, environmentalist Annie Leonard, it prompted a much deeper question. She asked, all the stuff that we buy, where does it come from and where does it go when we throw it out? This morning, she will share some of what she found as she traveled around the world looking for answers to those questions. You can find it in a book that she has published. Actually, you can also find it on the web. And it's all called The Story of Stuff. The book I'm now holding here in my hands, The Story of Stuff, has as its subtitle The Impact of Overconsumption on the Planet, Our Communities, and Our Health, and How We Can Make It Better. It is published by Simon & Schuster. You can also find out more about her by going to her website, storyofstuff.org. And both cases, the effort is to try to look at this idea that infinite growth is the best way to make a better world, takes on that notion, and also offers some suggestions for moving toward a more environmentally sustainable economic system. She is visiting the campus of the University of Illinois for the One Book, One Campus program of the Illini Union. And this is something they've been doing for a couple of years. We've seen programs like this other places around the country where the suggestion is as many people as possible all read the same book, and then it gives you something to talk about. And she will be talking about it on the U of I campus tonight at 7 o'clock at the Illini Union. This is a free talk. It's open to the public. Anybody who would like to attend is certainly welcome. And, of course, if you'd like to read the book, you can go to the bookstore or you can go to her website and you can see the web video that started all of this. Questions here on the program are welcome to 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. Also, you can send an email. Will-talk@illinois.edu. And Ms. Leonard, hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it. And we'll definitely talk about the story of stuff. I'm interested in having you tell the story of stuff, you know, the story of how you came to do this, because I think it's pretty interesting. But just as a way of starting out, the basic idea here is to look at the life cycle of our objects, those things that we buy and surround ourselves with and think are so important and in many ways, you know, add to our life. But what you're trying to get people to do is think about where they come from and not just the store where they bought them, but how it is they're made and then what happens when we're finished with them.
Absolutely. I just want people to think more critically and be more aware that all of this stuff in our lives, you know, our shoes, our furniture, our clothes, our cell phones, our gadgets, everything, it actually comes from someplace. I mean, someone mined those metals. Someone worked in that factory. You know, it was packed into ships and trucks and trains and sent all over the world. Just to think about where it came from, what were the impacts along the way, where is it going to go when we're done with it, but also the toll it's taking it home. You know, we often think that, oh, it's just some poor third world country that's getting devastated to supply us this stuff and get dumped on, but actually we're paying a pretty big price right here at home for all our stuff too. So I just want us to think a little more critically about all this stuff in our lives, and as I said in the book, how we can make it better.
Mm-hmm. Apparently, this is something that started some time back when the story I've heard is that you were in New York and you were there, I think, to be a student, and you were walking down the street, and everywhere you looked, there were people had put out their trash, and you started thinking, I wonder what's in all this trash.
That's exactly right. It was every single day of 4 years of college. You know, and I'm from Seattle, Washington, where we don't have piles of garbage all over. But anyone who's been to New York knows that you walk along the sidewalk there, and there are shoulder-high piles of garbage every single day. And so every morning I would walk these 6 blocks to my college class and see these shoulder-high piles of garbage. And I was just like, what is in all of that stuff? And then every afternoon I'd come home and it was gone. I was like, where did that go? Just the sheer mass of it just was so fascinating. So that's where I started my habit, which I still have to this day, to the embarrassment of my travel companions, is I look in garbage wherever I go. I really recommend it. When you go to a new city, a new country, look in the garbage. It is like reading a community's secret diary. You can find out so much of what's happening.
Well, okay, if we were to look at the garbage that people out there, people put out there in the streets of New York, opened up those bags, what sort of things do you find?
Well, the first thing that struck me when I did this was how much paper there was, and that today, still, where recycling has been, you know, a household word now for at least one or two generations, where paper is so easy to reduce and recycle. I mean, it's just, there is no excuse to be throwing this stuff away anymore. 40% of our garbage in this country is paper. I mean, that is just criminal. When you think that we could reduce it so much by using both sides, getting off junk mail list, and then we could be recycling this, decreasing the pressure to harvest more for us. I mean, it's just nuts to throw this valuable resource away. And so when I opened up those bags, I thought, oh, my God, those are papers. And I'm from the Northwest, where I did a lot of hiking growing up and saw clear cuts. And I used to, as a kid, wonder, what's up with those clear cuts? Like, I was too young to know about carbon sequestration and hydrological cycles and all these reasons we actually need forests to live on this planet. I just remember as a kid looking at these clear cuts and wondering, why would someone cut down all those trees? And then I put it together. When I saw this paper in the garbage, I'm like, this is what the trees are being cut down for? So I said, well, what happens to it next? Like, I began to put together the pieces.
Yeah, and then, well, so, okay, so how did you go from that to traveling the world, visiting not only places where materials are extracted, so that's where stuff begins, but also I think that you visited some of those places where stuff ends up.
Well, the first dump I ever went to, I will never forget it. It's a life-changing experience. And again, I really encourage listeners, if you haven't been to a big dump, go look. It is just fascinating to see what is, you know, spewed out the end of our consumer culture. My first dump was on Staten Island. It's New York City's Freshkills. It's actually called Freshkills Landfill.
Mm-hmm.
And it's absolutely gigantic. If you can imagine, I was standing there as a college kid looking as far as I could see in every single direction was furniture and appliances and shoes and books. I could not believe the books. I also couldn't believe how much food was in there. It was just stunning to me, the level of waste. And I had been raised in a family where we didn't waste, not because we realized that we were bumping up against the planet's ecological limits, but because losers waste. Like, why would anyone waste? And then to see this incredible level of waste just really sparked my curiosity even more. So I went down to Washington, D.C. when I graduated from school, and I started working for an environmental organization on the issue of waste. And I worked all over the United States looking at where waste was going. And what happened at this time was a really interesting thing. Communities across the country were organizing to stop landfills and incinerators because of the environmental health problems and to promote real solutions like recycling and composting. And what we didn't expect is that some real schmucks who wanted to just keep making this waste started putting it on ships and sending it around the world to send it to so-called third world countries, sometimes lying about what it was, sometimes bribing an official, sometimes just going it and dumping it there. And so my job for over a decade was to track U.S. waste exported overseas. So it was fascinating. I went to Haiti, I went to South Africa, India, China, Indonesia, all these places where our country was actually sending everything from hazardous waste to regular garbage. And I worked with people in the importing ends. I was part of a global campaign to make it illegal to send waste from rich countries to poor countries. So that was really how I got to see firsthand the dumps where our stuff is dumped and the factories where our stuff is made.
Mm-hmm. So then the next step here is that you had done this, you had seen all these things, and you decided that it was something that people needed to know about. So you started to give the story of stuff as a talk. You would speak before groups, and apparently you did this hundreds of times.
Exactly. So I came back from living overseas, and I was frustrated at how much the real life of all of our stuff was kept out of sight and out of mind. You know, it wasn't in the commercials. It wasn't in the advertisements. All that we saw were these very short messages telling us to buy more stuff without encouraging us to think about where the stuff comes from, where it goes, and what the impact is along the way. And so I started looking at how were environmentalists talking about this? Who was talking about it? And what I saw is that environmentalists, and I can say this because I'm one of them, we have a problem, which is we are still stuck in this sort of myth that the truth will set us free. And so we run around with our charts and our graphs of ecological footprint and climate change, and we bombard people with facts, and we often leave them feeling scared or guilty or disempowered or depressed, and then we wonder why nobody wants to hang out with us and why people aren't joining the conversation. So I started to experiment. Is there a way to talk about this really, really serious issue? The issue is that we are using too much stuff. We're using too toxic stuff. And it's not even making us happy. Like, this is some serious issues that we need to talk about. So I started to experiment. Is there a way to talk about this that's fun and engaging, and it's not all about, you know, shame on you for owning an iPod or carry your own bag to the grocery store and it'll all be okay, but have a real adult engaging conversation. So I developed this live talk. It's a 45-minute talk that became so popular. I got asked to give it all over the country. I was just traveling, constantly giving it. And finally, when you give the same talk over and over, you hit this point where you think, I'm going to throw up if I give this talk again. Like, I cannot do it anymore. And every time I would give the talk, people would say, do you have a film of this? And literally for 4 years, I said, no one's going to watch a film of me talking about garbage. But finally, when I couldn't give the talk one more time, I had a friend of mine film me give it, and then I went to this wonderful organization called Free Range Studios. If you're ever bored and want to see some cool things online, Google Free Range Studios. They're a really creative social marketing company that figures out how to deliver fun, engaging online messages about ways to make the world better. I asked them, how might we capture this film online so that I can share it for free and not have to travel all over giving this talk? So we came up with this idea. We made this film. We put it online in December 2007. And in my wildest dreams, I said, I hope we get 50,000 people to see this. I said, if 50,000 people saw this little cartoon, it's a little 20-minute cartoon that talks about where our stuff comes from and where it goes. It's available free online at storyofstuff.org. I thought if 50,000 people see this, you know, we will really significantly turn the volume up on this conversation. And to my amazement, we got 50,000 views the first day. And we are now at about 13 million views in every country and territory on the planet.
Yeah, it's hugely, hugely popular. And I must say, it's also hugely entertaining. And I think that you're sneaking by through some really serious ideas by doing it in the way that you deliver it, I think.
Well, I think just because the planet is in serious trouble, just because global inequity is increasing, just because the climate is totally disrupted, perhaps beyond repair, it doesn't mean we have to also be in a bad mood. I mean, let's have fun while we're talking about this stuff and getting to work to make it better.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Annie Leonard. She's an expert in international sustainability and environmental health issues, creator of that internet film that we have talked about, Story of Stuff. And as she says, if you would like to see it, you can do that by going to her website, storyofstuff.org. It's also been produced as a book. If you like that form, it's titled The Story of Stuff, and Free Press is the publisher on the book. And I also want to mention that she is on the University of Illinois campus today and will be giving a talk about The Story of Stuff tonight at 7 o'clock at the Illini Union. And this is part of the Illini Union's One Book, One Campus program. That's their choice for this year. And the idea being that they're hoping to promote some discussion of an important issue by getting as many people as possible to read a book, and this is the one for this time around, Story of Stuff, and then to talk about it. So we're talking about it here this morning, and questions and comments are welcome, as always, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And if you would like to send us an email, you may also do that, will-talk@illinois.edu. You know, I think that, I think you touched on the issue of recycling, which it's really interesting to see what's happened with recycling from the point where it's gone to be kind of a hippie deal to something where it's really quite mainstream. And people, I think, are thinking about it, are less likely just to toss something on the ground or toss something in the garbage. And many cities have programs encouraging people to set aside recyclable items and then put them out and have them picked up and, you know, don't put them in the regular garbage. And you sort of wonder whether that has actually had an impact. Maybe it makes people feel good, but does it really matter much to the kind of problem that you're trying to point to in Story of Stuff?
Well, you know, recycling is funny because it is what I say, necessary but insufficient. There are many fabulous things about recycling, and absolutely we should all recycle. I mean, I feel like at this point recycling is like, you know, flossing your teeth and washing your hands after you use the toilet. This is like basic adult functioning at this point. I can't believe we still have to even advocate for more communities to implement recycling. We all need to recycle. So Absolutely, it helps. It helps for a number of reasons. It helps to reduce the stuff that we're throwing away, because when you throw something in the garbage, that's going to go to some landfill or some incinerator in a community where people live, probably low-income people of color, because that's these facilities are usually located in marginalized areas. It's going to add to the environmental burdens there. It's going to add to the asthma of the kids. It's going to hurt somebody if you throw that in the garbage. And so we don't want to put our stuff in the garbage. Also, recycling decreases the pressure to make new stuff. So every bit of paper that you recycle means less trees get cut down. Every bit of metal that you recycle means less mountains get blown up to get more metal. So absolutely we should recycle. The danger with recycling comes when people think that's all we need to do. You know, there's a famous mantra we all learn in kindergarten, it's reduce, reuse, recycle. And there's a reason recycling comes last, is that's what you do last. The real leverage for big change is the reduce and reuse. We need to reduce the overall amount of stuff that we are using. We need to waste less. We need to use less. We need to make our things last longer. Companies need to make our products more durable so that we can make them last longer. I mean, I remember as a kid, our toaster lasted my whole life. You know, now you're lucky to get a year or two out of it. So we need to use less things. So that's really the first one, is reduce and reuse. And then what we absolutely have to throw away, then we can recycle it.
One of the things that you really try to get across to people, and I think it's important, is to look at the entire life cycle, starting with extraction of raw materials that are used to make things. And I think, again, that probably when people, to the extent that people think about the problem of waste connected to our stuff, they're going to think about the end. They're going to think about the landfills and the garbage dumps, and they're going to think about recycling, and their attention is going to be there. But one of the things that you really try to draw people's attention to is the fact that on the other end, at the very beginning of the process, there is a tremendous amount of waste there. And there again, maybe people think about environmental impact of extraction, like, you know, mountaintop removal and things like that. But there is an awful lot of waste left over once the people who do the extraction get the stuff that they want. What's left is just left.
Right. There's been a very successful campaign by the industry that does what I call the individualization of the problem, that there's too much garbage because you didn't recycle or you didn't compost. Whereas I think absolutely in our personal lives, we should definitely be responsible. We should recycle and compost. Of course we should do that. But even if we could recycle and compost 100% of the waste coming out of our household, that is really the tip of the iceberg, because so much more waste is created upstream. On average, for every one garbage can that we put out on the curb from our households, 70 garbage cans for each one of ours was made upstream for mining and harvesting and processing and assembling and manufacturing all that stuff. So if we want to reduce waste, the real leverage is to go to where upstream, to where the stuff is mined and produced, especially where the companies are designing the products. You know, when we think about reducing the impact of our waste, as you said, we often think about the stuff at the end. We look at a pile of waste and say, okay, what can we do to reduce it? And in many ways, it's too late by then, because you got a big pile of garbage. I mean, there's really nothing great you can do with a big pile of garbage. So what we really need to do is intervene upstream with the product designers. That's where the real leverage is. About 80% of a product's impact is determined at the design stage. So by reaching out to product designers, getting involved in design ourselves if we're interested, we can make some real differences. Just, for example, things like using one kind of plastic. If you're going to recycle plastics, you have to separate the different types of plastic. There's a number of different resins, and they can't be reprocessed together. So if you have an item like a computer printer or a bottle that is made from more than one plastic type, you can't recycle it. Whereas if that company would just design it out of one single plastic type, then you could recycle it. So simple things like that upstream can have a huge impact throughout the whole life cycle of making stuff longer lasting, more recyclable, more repairable, just easier to manage.
Mm-hmm. Well, that, and I guess, and I don't know, but in a particular case like that, I'd think, well, is there a reason that they have all those different kinds of plastics, that different parts, they function better if they're made out of a particular kind of plastic, or is there truly no reason why everything couldn't be one kind?
You know, sometimes there's no reason. They just weren't thinking about it. A lot of the time, chemicals were synthesized before chemists were taught to think about human health impacts, or products were designed before people were thinking about garbage. So a lot of the times it wasn't malintent. It just wasn't on their radar screen. So what we need to do is get back to the drawing board. Sometimes it's just laziness. You know, the government recently helped to facilitate a an agreement with cell phone manufacturers to make one consistent charger. I mean, how many times have you been on a trip, you forgot your charger, and nobody else's charger in the whole meeting fits yours, so you got to go out and buy another one? That is crazy. So now, starting this year, there is going to be one consistent charger. I mean, sometimes we just need to get some new rules and say, hey, you guys, you know, speed it up. Make this stuff better.
Yeah. Well, I think that also, you know, one of the things we are reading about is that more and more companies are starting to think about how decisions that have environmental impact, and that you could make the argument should be done for environmental reasons, also do affect their corporate bottom line. And there are a number of people like Hunter Lovins, for example, is very big on this issue, and she's been on this program talking about it before, that you can persuade companies, you perhaps can persuade them to do the right thing for the environment by saying to them, oh, and by the way, if you do this, you're going to make more money. And that seems like that's the one argument that companies, after all, they are for-profit enterprises, will respond to if you can say to them, look, by doing these things, you can reduce your cost of production and thereby you can make more money. That's something that they understand, and it seems to be at least on, I don't know what on whether it's happening is happening on a very large scale or not. But there certainly are plenty of examples where companies have done just that.
Absolutely, I'll tell you. Some people ask me, how do I stay so hopeful? And I say one of the ways I stay so hopeful is looking at the kinds of innovations that are coming out of companies. I mean, there are clearly the laggard companies who just don't care at all, but there are a growing number of really innovative, dedicated companies. Now, I remember in my 20s, I wanted everyone to save the planet because they had a revelation and cared and felt that the Earth was sacred and all of this. At this point, I don't care why they save it. We just got to start improving how we function on this planet for whatever reason. And if they're doing it for economic reasons, God bless. Let's go. We just got to figure out how to make our stuff better, safer, cleaner, healthier. There are so many cases of companies that have saved enormous amounts of money, millions of dollars, creating less waste, using less energy, switching from a toxic chemical to a non-toxic chemical so they don't have to pay for all the worker exposure equipment and a hazardous waste disposal. There are so many cases. You know, if you're interested in this, one of the books I just love is by Ray Anderson. It's called Confessions of a Radical Industrialist, and it explains his own conversion from running this huge multinational company to being such a leader of sustainability and the things he did with that company. And his was a nasty company. One of the things he says is, if we could do it, anyone can do it. And if anyone can do it, then everyone can do it. So there's lots of exciting stuff on that. But there's a couple of problems. I mean, one is that our taxpayer dollars are still going to prop up what I call the dinosaur economy. So it's not really a level playing field. Our taxpayer dollars are disproportionately going to dirty industries, dirty energy. This is actually the topic of a new movie that we just released last week called The Story of Broke. And I made this film because when I go around the country and talk about how it is possible to make our stuff to be cleaner, healthier, safer, more durable, it really is possible to have a clean environment and safe products, people always raise their hands and say to me, oh, those are nice ideas, but there's no money for that. We're broke. And it just started frustrating me so much that I'm told that solar energy is too expensive, we're broke. Recycling is too expensive, we're broke. Product safety standards are too expensive, we're broke. When we're giving billions of dollars away to nuclear reactors, garbage incinerators, oil companies. So we made this little 7-minute cartoon that explains this and invites people to join us to demand that our government use our taxpayer dollars to build a better future rather than prop up these dirty industries. Because that would help a lot of these companies switch over to these cleaner technologies if they had support rather than giving our support to the dinosaurs that got us into this mess.
Yeah, all right. And again, that's something that people can see if they go to your website, storyofstuff.org, where they can also see the original Story of Stuff, and then there are a number of other things here that are the story of something, electronic, cosmetics, bottled water. You've used that same model now to tell a few other stories.
Right, and they're all short cartoons with lots of additional information on the website, a footnoted annotated script if you're wondering about any of my facts, ways to get involved, more information. It's all there at storyofstuff.org.
Yeah, and again, people can call in here with questions, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. To pick one thing, just because it seems that in a lot of respects it's one of our biggest problems in terms of waste, in terms of how the products are made, and also in terms of a planned obsolescence, the thing I'm thinking about is electronics. So iPods, cell phones, computers, things that where people are attracted to the idea of having the newest thing that does have the best features, that does get to a point where some manufacturers, eventually the older devices, they just stop supporting them. So there's a certain point comes when you feel that you have to make a change. But and then, of course, as I said, there are people who just always want whatever the newest thing is. How in an industry like that, which is really known for problems in the whole life cycle from manufacturing to disposal, and that has this urge always to produce something new, how do you apply some of these ideas about getting people to think more carefully about the product and the people who make it to get more to think more carefully about the product? How do you get them to try to do that?
Well, I'm so glad you asked about electronics, because when you look at today's electronics, they look so sleek and shiny and clean that it's easy to assume that their whole life cycle is a sleek and shiny and clean life cycle, and it is so far from that. You know, today's electronics use enormous amounts of toxic chemicals, enormous amounts of waste is produced. They use lots of water and energy, all the way from mining in the Congo to get some of the metals we need for our electronics, which is fueling violence and civil war, to where these things are dumped in China. The life cycle of today's electronics is an absolute disgrace. And because of the fast obsolescence and development of new products, e-waste, that's what we call old electronics, e-waste, you know, televisions, VCRs, I guess nobody even has those anymore, DVD players, I'm dating myself here, cell phones, all of these gizmos and gadgets that we throw out, that is the fastest growing part of our municipal garbage, and it is the most hazardous, because our actual phones and gadgets contain lead, cadmium, chemicals that cause cancer, reproductive problems, neurological problems. There's some really nasty stuff in our gadgets. So we have to tackle this on an individual level and on a societal level. On the individual level, we need to take care of our gadgets, take care of them, make them last as long as possible, eke every bit of use out of your product before you replace it. You know, resist the upgrade. Do not take your phone in and give another one just because someone called you and offered you one now in pink or silver or, you know, with a 3D camera or whatever the newest gadget is. Really make these things last. You know, many people often accuse me of being anti-stuff, and I say, actually, I'm pro-stuff. I want us to have more appreciation for our stuff. You know, I look at my cell phone, and I imagine the guys in Africa who had to work in some mine to get these metals out, the women in the factories in China who were risking their ability to have healthy children to put this stuff together. You know, have a little respect for these folks and make it last as long as possible. So that's on the individual level. No, we should definitely take individual responsibility, but we are also never going to solve the problem just by eking out another year of use out of each one of our little cell phones that are designed to break anyway. You know, the only consumer product with a shorter life cycle than a cell phone these days is an ice cream cone. It just drives me nuts. But what we really need to do is get the manufacturers to change how they make it. We need to get them to get the toxic chemicals out and then to make these things last longer. Now, it's true that there is often technological innovation, but if they could design them modular, you could take out the old part and snap in the new part. So, for example, when my laptop breaks or, you know, the inside is something's wrong with some actual machinery inside, I have to chuck the whole thing, whereas the case and the keyboard still works fine. Why not just open it up and snap out the parts that need to be upgraded? So things like modular design, toxics-free design. And I like to tell folks in the United States that it is possible because the European Union, the entire European Union, has passed some regulations about electronics, and they have said that electronics have to be free of a whole range of really toxic chemicals, things that really cause cancer, neurological problems. They're not allowed in electronics in Europe, but those same companies are still making electronics here with those toxic chemicals. And so we really need to push back and say, hey, if you can get rid of those toxic chemicals in Europe, why not here? Why not everywhere? We need to really push these companies to make our products safe and make them last. And if you'd like to get involved, there's a thriving campaign to do that. Please go to our website, storyofstuff.org. Watch the film called The Story of Electronics, which explains more about this. And then there's lots of ways to get involved and really force these companies to produce quality products that aren't trashing the planet or workers or us.
All right. We're talking this morning in this hour of focus with Annie Leonard about the story of stuff. She's here visiting the campus. We'll give a talk. I'll tell you about that again a little bit later in the second part of the show. First, though, we'll take a quick break. This is Focus.
Support comes from Subaru of Champaign County, located on Route 45 in Savoy. Dedicated to preserving our planet, the Subaru Assembly Plant in Lafayette, Indiana, achieves zero landfill status, with nothing from its manufacturing efforts going into a landfill. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. SubaruofChampaign.com or 352-4700.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings from 10 to noon with 10 different topics for you every week. I want to make a point of talking about a special show that we're doing tonight on our companion station, WILL Television. The main theme of the second hour today and also of this program that we're doing tonight is hunger in central Illinois. And we'll be talking with people who are involved in fighting it. In the next hour, we will talk with Tracy Smith, who is the Illinois State Director for Feeding Illinois, which is the network of state food banks. Also, Mike Meese will join us. He's administrator with the Midwest Food Bank, which is something that started on a farm in McLean County, and it's a really great story. And they have since grown very big and provided food to people around the country and, in fact, in other countries as well. Tonight on WILO TV at 7 o'clock, we're going to be playing a special program developed by the Sesame Workshop folks that is all designed to get families and children particularly thinking about this issue, the fact that there are many families where they're having a hard time feeding their families. After that, at 8 o'clock, we will be live in the studio for a special program. We'll have several panels of people from Central Illinois who are working on this issue. People from food pantries, people from food banks, trying to get an idea of what the scope of the problem is. And also then at 9 o'clock, we will have an online chat, and that will be an opportunity for people to ask questions, make comments, ask about what they may do, ask about where resources are. So it's a big day of programming that we're doing all on this particular theme. So I hope that you can stay with us for the 11 o'clock show, and then you can tune in tonight between 7 and 9 for this program that we're doing on WILL Television. This morning in this hour of Focus, Annie Leonard is our guest. She is an expert in international sustainability and environmental health issues. She is the creator of the internet film The Story of Stuff, which you can see on her website, storyofstuff.org, and it's also available as a book, The Story of Stuff. She's on the campus for the One Book, One Campus program sponsored by the Illini Union. It's one of those things where they suggest everybody read the same book, and then that promotes discussion of the thing that the book is about. And she will be giving a talk. It's free tonight on the campus at 7 o'clock at the Illini Union in the Illini Union rooms. And anybody who would like to hear her should feel welcome to stop by. And of course, you can head out to the bookstore and look for The Story of Stuff, or if you want to watch it, you can go to her website. And we have several callers here to bring into the conversation. So let us do that. And we'll start with somebody in Champaign and line number one. Hello.
Hi there.
Yes.
Hi there. This is all really exciting, and I love to hear that there's solutions in the works. Bill and Melinda Gates Foundations tries to do a lot of good in the world. Anti-malarial, I know, is one of their big issues. What is their opinion about this? Are they taking a stance? Are they working towards solving these electronic waste products? And I'm going to listen offline.
Okay.
Well, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has focused mostly on health issues, so they have not been very involved in these issues around e-waste. You know, much to my dismay, I wish that they would be more more involved. I have gone to meet the foundation members just once about waste management. They were open to discussion. I gave them some information, but we haven't seen a huge amount of response yet. If you wanted to write them a letter, as well as to Microsoft, and say, you know, make your products safe, make them clean, make them last, make them more easily to recycle, that would be fabulous.
Then it sounds like that's really what people have to do. And not only that, if they can, if there are choices, they should make choices in their buying that, if it's possible, that line up with their values. Now, I don't know if, in fact, if there is a computer that is like that. Is there a green computer, for example, that you can buy?
You know, there's not a green computer, and that's the limitation of the sort of vote-with-your-dollar approach. A lot of people say, well, make the right choice in the grocery store, but the choices that are available to us are limited and predetermined by forces outside of the grocery store, by government regulation and by businesses, and that's where we really need to focus. If you are interested in buying stuff better, I want to encourage you to check out a source online called Good Guide, GOODGUIDE. Good Guide rates thousands and thousands of products on environmental health and social issues and is a very reliable source of information. So you can screen your computers, your shampoos, your potato chips, whatever it is you're buying through them and get a lot of information about the products. But the real leverage is not at the grocery store. Our real position of power is by engaging in the democratic process and demanding better laws so that we don't have to learn which shampoo or which cell phone does or doesn't have carcinogens, because no shampoo and no cell phone should have carcinogens.
Yeah, okay. To another caller here, line number two, someone in Urbana. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm really excited for the talk tonight. I saw the video my friend showed it to me in high school and sort of reintroduced me to this whole field of sustainability and all that. So thank you for that. My question is, you mentioned about product design and how the onus is really on the manufacturer on designing better, more sustainable, more environmentally friendly products. And I completely agree with you, but I think, you know, it'd be pretty easy for me to play devil's advocate and say, well, a modular design requires more space. It's less, it's less attractive to the customer. You can compare Macs and PCs, for example, where Macs are sort of unibody and a PC is much more modular, but, you know, people really prefer the Mac. I could make similar arguments for, you know, using certain materials. There's a cost and benefit and all of that. So I think there's a lot of issues there that, you know, people need to work out, and sort of a balance needs to be struck, especially the approach to design we take in this country. For example, if, you know, there's a story about how they created a X-ray machine here and then shipped it over to another country as a donation, and they ended up using it just the TV. That was a funny thing. But anyway, sorry. My question is, in other countries, you take Egypt or India, they have entire sort of cottage industries where families will go and sort through garbage and, sort of use what they can find. There's sort of like a second market after the landfill, where here, once it goes to the landfill, it stops. Why is that sort of second life that things have, or, you know, maybe it's a third or fourth life in some cases, why don't we have that here? And how is there a way that we can sort of implement that type of thinking where, you know, after it's hit the landfill, there's a further process where it gets a new life? Thank you.
Right, so the term cottage industry makes it sound so quaint. So what it really is that it's a vicious life for a number of very, very poor people in developing countries. It's often called scavenging or informal recycling. But all over, if you go to landfills or any big cities in third world countries, you will see, you know, thousands and thousands of people who survive from scavenging landfills to find reusable things to then sell. And often they live, there's whole communities on the sides of dumps where tens of thousands of people live out of homes made out of stuff from the dump. And it's really a mess. And actually, I'm doing work with those folks around the world to clean that up so that it could be a healthy, dignified job. The better thing than letting really poor people dig through the dump to find stuff is stop the stuff from getting mixed into the dump in the first place by having really good, aggressive, responsible recycling program that pulls out the reusable stuff before it gets mixed in with the garbage to be used. In terms of electronics, the European Union is such a great model because they're really experimenting with some of the most innovative approaches, and we can see how it works and then learn from them. They have implemented a regulation that I really recommend for this country. It's called Extended Producer Responsibility, or EPR. And under EPR, the theory is that the company that manufactured the product should have control of it or responsibility of it at the end of its useful life cycle. Because right now, a company can make some poorly designed, toxic-containing, you know, shoddy piece of junk like a cell phone or, some electronic gadget. And when we're done with it, which is often very soon, we just put it out in the municipal waste stream, and then the city has to figure out how to deal with this thing that contains all these toxics. Under EPR, these devices go back to Panasonic, Sony, Toshiba, whoever it is that manufactured them. The theory is that this is then a built-in system to keep this stuff out of the garbage so that it can be recycled safely, but also to encourage the companies to come up with better design to get the toxics out. I mean, if they have to get this device back with five different kinds of plastic and lead and cadmium and PVC and all this, they're not going to want that on their doorstep either. So they will actually ask their designers to make it easier to recycle it because they're going to be the ones stuck with recycling it. So that's called Extended Producer Responsibility, or EPR, and we're really excited. It's beginning to catch on in some states here in the United States. To find out more about that, check out the Electronics Take Back campaign.
Yeah, and that's a something I think is going to be more and more of an issue, as in more and more places it becomes illegal to put those sorts of things in the municipal waste stream. I think here, for example, in the state of Illinois, and I know in other countries, other states, it's already illegal. I do believe here in the state of Illinois, as of the end of this year, it will no longer be legal to toss your television, your cell phone, your computer, your CD player, you know, what have you, into the garbage and have that go off and go to the landfill.
That's great because there are so many toxics, but where the catch is, there's also little bits of valuable materials. Every one of these cell phones has about 50 cents worth of gold in it, little bits of copper. So how can we get the valuable materials out, put them back into productive use without exposing these recycling workers to toxic chemicals if we've got to get the toxic chemicals out of our cell phones?
Yeah, and there's no doubt about it. The thing we're talking about here is, say, for example, with electronics, this is a real design challenge. So one shouldn't minimize that. But I think also there's something here that's going on, and I'm sure that if you went to a big computer manufacturer and you said to them, can you make me a green computer? And they'd say, well, sure we can, but it's going to cost you twice as much, you know. So now, rather than having a situation where you can go out and get a very powerful, sophisticated computer for under $1,000, if you want your green computer, it's going to cost more. Now, although at the same time, alongside that, you probably want to lay the idea that, well, we're really not paying right now in the things that we're buying that we think are good deals. We're really not paying the cost, the true cost of those things.
Right. One of the things that I talk about in the story of stuff is externalized costs of production. And that means that the true costs of all the things that we buy are not actually captured in the price. So that's how we can go into Target or Walmart and buy a radio for $4, is because we're not actually paying the price of the metals that were mined in Africa and the damage to the community's water supply there, or the future of the kids who aren't going to school because they're mining instead, and the pollution from the factory. And all along this dirty production life cycle, costs of making this stuff, whether it's health costs for the worker, health costs for the community, contaminated water sites for the community, there's all these costs that aren't included in the price. So it really is skewing the market signals and making unhealthy stuff look like it's less expensive than healthy stuff, whereas if you actually had full cost accounting, that's simply not the case. But the other thing is that when these computer guys say that they can't figure out how to make a green computer, we just know that is not true. These guys are geniuses. I mean, in my high school, we had one computer that took up an entire room, and everybody in the class got 15 minutes on it per semester. And now my watch has a higher computing capacity than that entire computer. I mean, my gosh, these guys are absolute geniuses. If they put their genius to getting toxic chemicals out of these products, making them more durable, making them more upgradable, they could just solve this, I bet, in minutes. They are so smart.
We have a couple of callers here that we want to get in, and about 10 minutes left, a little bit less in the show. By the way, talking this hour with Annie Leonard. She is the creator of Story of Stuff. It is available as a book, also as it started out its life as an internet movie and still is there. And if you'd like to find out more about her or look at it, see it, it's at storyofstuff.org. Here's some other callers in Belgium next, line number 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you both. I hope I'm not going to get too far off the topic here, but let me stray on. One of the things you see on TV is, and it just upsets me greatly, is these clean coal commercials. There's nothing clean about coal. It's a complete lie. But that's not here. Another thing that we talk about, not recycling in discussion, that we should recycle it every day, are fluorescent bulbs. Fluorescent bulbs are full of mercury. It can be recycled easily. Just nobody wants to gather them up and take them to a central location. We put them all in the landfill, which that's the worst place to put mercury that's going to get broken out of these things and go around. But the real question I wanted to point, or thing I wanted to point out to you is, I'm involved with an organization called the AAW. It's the American Association of Woodturners. We have pushed long for getting things on public television, any television, that will show how to do wood turning and stuff like that. And now Create TV has come along, and we think maybe that might have been a little bit of us, because we've screamed so long at people to get things on to show how to do crafts and stuff like that. But if there's a real pushback against things of this sort to show how people make things and do things, because they don't think there's quite enough interest in it, because if we know how things are made, we might be able to push public policy to create cleaner areas and better ways to deal with it. And I was wondering, when you put your things, well, obviously on the internet it's easy to put on because you don't have to worry about producers and the whole rigmarole of being involved with a more national media type thing. But maybe you ran into the same problem, the same pushback, that people don't really want to hear about this stuff.
Well, you know, when I made the Story of Stuff film, I even thought people didn't want to hear about it. I thought, how many people are going to watch me talk about where stuff comes from and where it goes? And what I found is that there's a real hunger for this. I mean, we literally, over 13 million people have seen it online, plus we've distributed about 20,000 DVDs to group settings, to countries where they don't have high-speed enough internet to watch it online, and to colleges, things like that. So we're guessing about 15 million people have seen it. I got 250,000 emails asking me for more information, and that's why I ended up writing the book. So I think there is a real hunger for this kind of conversation. After the Story of Stuff film did so well online, a number of television producers came and talked to me about going on commercial television, and I met a number of them, and I just decided it's not worth it. It's too much of a pain in the neck. With the internet, we can reach millions and millions of people for free. There's been such a democratization of communication, and anybody can do this, and you can even host this stuff for free on YouTube now. I mean, you can really do, you can reach anybody, anytime, anywhere. So it's, I would say, don't even worry about the commercial televisions. Make your own content, put it up on the internet, share it with friends, and we can just bypass that whole sort of, you know, dinosaur communication technology.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And again, to another caller, this is Edgar County, line one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. Annie, may I call you?
Yes.
I appreciate your work. It's very good. I've been involved with recycling for 40 years. I was the first Earth Day in Central Park. I worked with the City of New York to develop the recycling program. Fresh Kills is 150 to 200 feet high, right?
It's gigantic.
That's a mountain.
Highest point. He's talking about the landfill on Staten Island where
yes.
The garbage goes. It's the highest point on the eastern seaboard.
That's right. It's been closed for two decades, except when it was opened after 9/11. And, you know, it's being turned into a ski slope, I think. But anyway, the situation is I've worked with Reynolds Aluminum to start the aluminum recycling, worked, you know, with newspapers and such as that for the entire city. And the situation is that one thing that in setting up that little triangle for the reduce, we didn't put in the saying rethink. And that's the problem with people, is they don't think. They just toss it. And you know, it's easy for them to do because, first of all, we don't have any system, like, for instance, here in central Illinois, where a system is set up. This Saturday is going to be the last day when we will have recycling at Edgar County, which is only for 1 hour on a Saturday from 9 till 10. The city won't support it. The county won't support it. And you can talk to them, and there's money out there that doesn't want it. You know, I'm sorry to be negative. I've been in this for 40 years and firmly believe in it. But it's tough.
It is tough, but, you know, undermining the ecological systems on which life depends is even worse. When people tell me it's going to be so hard to make things better, I say it's going to be a lot harder to not make things better. So it absolutely is tough. Let's take care of each other, have fun while we're doing it, but we absolutely can make things better. For folks that are promoting recycling, which is such a good thing to be promoting, one of the angles that I find works really well right now is the job creation potential in recycling. Depending on what kind of recycling program you have, you can have 10 to 50 times more jobs per ton of material processed than if you burned it in an incinerator or dumped it in a landfill. And there's a new report that's just out, I believe it was just out yesterday, by the Teamsters and Gaia, which is a global anti-incineration alliance, a group that works on waste in 90 countries. This new report has come out and found out that if we had a 75% recycling goal in this country nationally, which we already have that in California, we have it in lots of places, nationally, if we had a 75% recycling goal, that'd be 1.5 million new jobs. That's 1.5 million jobs, put people going right back to work, plus much less waste going into landfills and incinerators, so we save all that money, prevent all that pollution, and less pressure to harvest and mine new stuff. So if you can't get people on board recycling just because it's the right thing to do, talk about jobs, because that is on the top of everybody's priority list these days.
Any follow-up you'd like to do?
I think that's very good, but the situation is we can't even get it done on a volunteer level with support here.
So in Edgar County, there's nobody that's doing recycling?
Nope. Do it for 1 hour. It's done by two people who volunteer their trucks, and they have to haul it to Terre Haute.
I think it's great when people do volunteer, but when we're trying to promote people doing the right thing, we should try to figure out ways to make it as easy as possible for them to do the right thing. If the extra onus is on them, like if I got to put the kids in the station wagon and haul the stuff to the recycling place at that 1 hour, which might coincide with my kid's soccer game, and that's a pain in the neck, and that's going to deter a lot of people. So what we really need to do is organize to get the city to provide curbside cycling, and then there's a whole variety of ways, as I'm sure you know, but the listeners may not, to make it more accessible. So, for example, where I live, we have what's called pay-as-you-throw, whereas my recycling gets picked up free, my composting gets picked up free, but I pay for my garbage. And if I get the smallest garbage can, which is what I have, it's $8 a month, and it's small. And I can go all the way up to the biggest one. Like, I have these really piggy neighbors who have the biggest one. They're paying $60 a month for their garbage to get taken away. I'm paying $8 because I've committed to reducing my garbage. So that means I can't afford to put any recyclables in my garbage. I can't afford to forget my own bags from the grocery store and have to come home with a whole bunch of bags and extra packaging to be thrown away. So things like that that provide a financial incentive and that make it as easy as possible for people to participate will increase participation rates enormously. If they have recycling for 1 hour a weekend and they say, well, look, nobody wants to recycle, that is not a fair analysis.
Yeah. Well, you know, I appreciate the comments of the caller. I'm sorry to have to end on a note like that, but we have to because we're here at the end of the time. Once again, I want to say if you're interested in the story of stuff, it is available as a book. That's the title, Story of Stuff. It's published by Free Press, so you can look for that in the bookstore. You can see the original film, The Story of Stuff, and then a number of others that Annie Leonard has done Story of at their website, storyofstuff.org. So if you have internet access, you can go there and you can look at them. And if you're in and around Champaign-Urbana, she is here on the campus as part of the Illini Union's One Book, One Campus program. Everybody's reading The Story of Stuff, and she'll be giving a free public lecture tonight at 7 o'clock at the Illini Union. So anyone who is interested in hearing her should feel welcome. Also, there'll be a reception and a book signing afterwards, so you can meet her, and that way you get a copy of the book. Ms. Leonard, thank you very much for talking with us today. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. I hope to meet a bunch of your listeners tonight.
All right. We'll take a break here, as we usually do at this point, so we can bring you some news from National Public Radio and an update on the market. So please stay tuned.